ladies and gentlemen, Greg Warren.
All started a while ago. I was in Iowa and I was doing a show, and there was a bunch of farmers in the crowd, and I don't know anything about farming. I live in the suburbs of St. Louis. I told that story later, and this lady came up to me after the show. She goes, "Hey, I'm a farmer." He goes, "I met this guy the other day. He didn't know the difference between field corn and sweet corn." What a dummy. If you don't know the difference between field corn and sweet corn, field corn, that's what they grind up and they feed to the animals, and sweet corn, that's what we eat. And once they explain it, it's very easy to remember, because field corn is grown in a field, whereas sweet corn is grown in a field. So you can see these farmers make it real easy to understand their stuff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and that was part of Greg Warren's new stand-up special, Where the Field Corn Grows, filmed and recorded in Edwardsville, Illinois, and soon to be available on June 30th at Amazon, Amazon Prime Direct, Google Play, Xbox Video, and Vudu. It'll also drop as an album on July 21st with 800-pound Gorilla Record. That's Where the Field Corn Grows by Greg Warren. Warren grew up in St. Louis, grew a fondness for baseball in St. Louis, and now takes St. Louis baseball with him on the road to his gigs, sometimes watching that one last at-bat before taking the stage. You may have seen Greg on Late Night with Seth Meyers, Last Comic Standing, The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, the Stan Musial Awards, and on and on and on. I last saw him in Fort Myers when, well, goodness, I last saw baseball. He was out at the Cardinals' penultimate road game there against the Twins in spring before the season, the schedule, the game came to a halt. Before a recent show in Myrtle Beach, Greg was kind enough to join St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist Ben Fredrickson and I to talk baseball, comedy, wrestling, and, yes, our shared alma mater, the Mizzou J School. But before that, let me tell you about our sponsor, Closet by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closet by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. That's Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. The official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. Look, baseball had a tough weekend, a bad PR weekend. The negotiations seem like a joke to get the 2020 season going. So we turned to a homegrown, standout, stand-up comedian to help put a smile back on our face. Here's our conversation with Greg Warren. So, Greg, I guess we should start here. It's a baseball podcast, and we have you on here right as you get ready for your special Where the Field Corn Grows debuts on Amazon, Amazon Prime. And then, of course, we've got about a month before the album drops there on July 21st, which is a great day that we can discuss at another point. It may be someone's birthday on this podcast.
Oh.
But since the title of the thing is Where the Field Corn Grows, and I know part of it is discussing the difference between field corn and sweet corn, can you tell us which one is best for ghosts of former baseball players?
For ghosts of former baseball players, man, I'm going to guess that was field corn that we were seeing in that film. And I would not have known that. Interestingly enough, this special all started with sort of a joke that something that happened on stage in the state of Iowa, which is, I believe, what you're referencing, the state of Iowa,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Have you been? Have you been to that?
We just call it
field?
Heaven.
Yeah. Have you been there?
I have. Yeah, I've been there multiple times. My dad actually hit a home run into the corn.
No way, man. No way. Did Ray Liotta bring the ball back to him?
Did he caught it? He said, "You're out." No, I'm just kidding. No. I had to go into the corn and fetch it myself.
Yeah. And when you were in the corn, Ray Liotta was in there filming a Chantix commercial. Actually,
I thought you guys were. I'm confused. You guys are talking about you know, Field of Dreams. When you said ghosts of former baseball players, I thought you guys were talking about 2020.
Yeah. Oh man, guys, this is horrible.
It's bad.
It's really, really bad, man. Nobody, I've you know, listened to a lot of both you guys talk about it, and I've read all your stuff, and it, man, as of like yesterday, I'm starting to think this could maybe not happen.
It wasn't too long ago that we all saw each other at a ball field there in Fort Myers, right, Greg? You were there to see the Cardinals play the Twins. Gung Young Kim had a tremendous outing. I mean, it seems like this was like 16 years ago. An assertive outing, really, that put him in the rotation. And then everything kind of came undone after that.
Yeah, that was, that was the last gig I did. It was in Port Charlotte, Florida. And I was so excited because I got to see a spring training game, which is the first one I've been to in years. I saw you guys down there. And I was getting ready to go to one, I think, a couple of days later. And that didn't happen. And, that may be the last baseball that I'll watch for quite some time. I hope not. I really hope not. I mean, the funny thing is, like, everybody's saying, you know, baseball better watch out. They're going to lose a lot of fans and followers, and they will, I think, if this thing continues to go south. But I know me. I'll be back no matter what they do. They can do just horrible things. I mean, seriously, you don't want to know the horrible things they could do. And I'll be like, yeah, okay. But I mean, but who's playing first?
It's the second unlimited second chance. It's like, well, give them a second chance. Well, it's actually their 30th chance. Well, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, those guys. Yeah. Yeah. Derek, I read something today that you posted it looks like there's like 7 or 8 owners that probably don't want to play.
Oh no. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, there has been this, let's say small group, and it's probably grown over time, of owners that say like, look, if there's no season, then that's okay, because the cost of pulling off games is more expensive and will cost us more than not playing at all. It's the classic kind of decision, right? Like, are you worried about the revenue of today, or are you willing to lose a little now to invest in the future? And there are owners that are like so dependent on ticket sales and so on the precipice, because they've been running slim margins for whatever reason, whether it's launching their own TV network or investment in free agents or capital improvements to the ballpark or loans that they have to pay back or whatever reason, debt services that they have coming up, who say, well, better to not play at all and have that cost of players. Like, say you have a super expensive salary that you just want to avoid, than to play part of a season. And there's a group, they haven't really been identified. There's been a lot of speculation as to who it is. The Cardinals are a team that rely heavily on ticket sales. So you would do the math in your head real quick and go, well, they might be a team that would benefit from not playing, considering the contracts they have and how reliant they are on tickets. But they aren't. They're one of the teams that want to play. And their owner happens to have appeared to have some really strong influence with the commissioner before. He's had a real difficult week of PR.
Yeah. That's great to hear that the Cardinals aren't one of those teams. So is it people that just owners that don't have enough cash? I think I heard Klabe say on your podcast, there's some owners that probably are not as well funded as they should
listening.
Be. Yeah, no, I thought it was great. It's weird, man. I feel like I should be cleaning right now, because I listen to you guys when I clean, and I'm not a cleaner. Like, in all honesty, I have somebody that Becky comes and cleans my house like once a month, and I'm hardly ever home. And I during the pandemic, I was like, all right, I need to buckle down and just do my own cleaning here. So I listen to like 2 or 3 BPIBs while I'm cleaning. So I feel like I feel like I should be polishing windows or something like that. Yeah. Who am I kidding? Well, I don't polish windows. What am I? Yeah.
For Derek, he invokes, and people see him and they just automatically smell Febreze. It's become like a Pavlov Pavlov's reaction, where like they see him and they like trigger cleaning smells. It's
I get that.
It's quite quite the phenomenon since the podcast.
I was just Klaibs was saying, I think on one of those podcasts, that like, hey, these guys don't have enough money to have a baseball team. Basically, they aren't as well fun as they should, and it sort of reminds me of like back in the day. Didn't they say like Bill Bidwell kind of? I think he relied on the St. Louis Cardinal football team to make money. It wasn't like there wasn't other businesses or something. I remember hearing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's So that's part of it. Is like, okay, where is this? Where's the owner's other business? So what is his kind of like personal business for him to rely on? And then what is the baseball team? For a lot of them, it is a money generating thing. Now they have, you know, for the most part, most of the baseball owners have, you know, come from a lot of money, come from another successful business. I mean, you know, and that runs the gamut from where what Bill DeWitt is in, where, you know, he's acquiring companies and moving them around, and, you know, has sort of a classic business, you know, purchase, improve, purchase, break down, move on, sell kind of approach, or the art dealer that used to own the Marlins. You know, so they run the gamut. But Klaibs' point was about like cash resources, like how much do they have on hand for an emergency? And I think so many teams, the phrase is that, you know, they run such tight margins that when you take away, when you just turn the spigot off of ticket sales, you're cutting off like a rather major revenue stream for them that they rely on, that all of their loans are based on, that their mortgages, you know, to use that word, sort of in the sense of what they have to pay on their ballparks or pay on, you know, their land or pay on their rent or whatever, you know, that is based around, you know. And I've asked around, you know, did anybody, the Cardinals are insurance to their gills, but they don't have pandemic insurance. You know, they didn't invest in the, like Wimbledon did in this notion that like, okay, well, you could have a pandemic shut down the game. So, you know, where do they get the protection from the loans that they own? I mean, they're in a way, they're just like us, you know, where, you know, we've all experienced furloughs in the newspaper business. I can't really call, you know, somebody up and say, hey, you know, can you forgive my mortgage this year month? Because, you know, oh man, bummer, I got furloughed. It doesn't work that way. And same with baseball teams. If they're, you know, gliding along the margins, relying on their ticket sales to support them, that's a net zero now. And even though they're not playing payer salaries, you know, it's still really hard for them to come back. So it's a fascinating, I think we've learned more about how precarious owners are, and maybe that sings out than we ever knew in the past.
I think part of it is also too, is this is what the owners are saying they are. We don't, what then this is the players' argument, is the players are saying, if this is the case, then give us the proof. And, you know, the owners and players share certain documents through the MLBPA, but they're not going to, they never and won't open up their books and show really the true financial concern. And the players have been led to believe over the course of their interactions with the owners that they're exaggerated. To some degree, it's business, but, you know, and everybody's business is taking a hit during this time, but very few businesses are sitting on organizations that are valued like baseball teams are. I mean, we hear a lot about how these owners don't have cash flow. And in this case, that may be true, but they're also sitting on assets that are valued at billions of dollars that have, you know, increased greatly over, you know, over recent years. So I think that's where you see the questioning of, you know, some of these statements. And really, unless you're going to prove them to be true, then they're going to be questioned. You know, and certainly some owners are in better shape than others. But this notion that there are owners who would convince themselves that it's better off to not play the game, that they own one of 30 teams in, than to try to find a way forward. I think that's something that should be shot down by owners who care about the game and care about the longevity of it and the livelihood of it. Because to let that get out, that there are more than five, you know, maybe as many as 10 teams that are just rather not have a season, I mean, that raises real questions about who's running these teams and who's steering this game.
Absolutely. It was horrible to read this morning. There's eight guys that don't want to play, in addition to the eight teams that are tanking every year, I guess.
which owners don't speak out against either. I mean, that's the thing is the owners are unified and they look out for each other. And I think that's the frustrating thing a lot of times is that you wish they looked out for the game as much as they looked out for each other.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point because like there are different like types of teams though, right? Like we look at this probably from a St. Louis perspective. You know, Greg's from St. Louis. I'm the grandson of a Cardinal fan, and Ben, you're from Sedalia in Missouri, so closer to the Royals side, but in the middle. So we think of probably the Cardinals as like a public trust, right? Like their owners are stewards of their history, and they possess it for a short time, and then they move on to the next steward of the team. I'm not sure that that applies with other teams, though, where, they're businesses. I mean, you'd like to think that baseball teams are part of every community in the same way the Cardinals are, but I don't know if we can say that.
Yeah, you're right. And certainly few teams have the connection with their community as the Cardinals do, which to me is even more reason the Cardinals should be one of the lead voices in this of saying, hey, these are all the reasons we should be trying to find a way forward. And unfortunately, those haven't been the comments really that we've heard from the Cardinals. I don't think to the degree that they should make them, but yeah, I mean, you have, and that gets back to what Greg was talking about is at some point, I think baseball and the teams that do rely on those fans do have to fold into this conversation to some degree, the backlash and the potential downside that there could be to having this fight, especially if it ends like it, could in the worst case scenario, because if ticket sales are that important as we're learning during this process, and if that is such a huge driver for baseball, then you better make sure you're not, alienating fans who aren't going to be there when the ticket sales are an option again.
Yeah. Hey, what if they did a thing where because you can't have a lot of fans going to baseball games, but what if they like sold 100 tickets for each game to rich guys, It's like for $250,000, you have the run of the stadium. Like you can do whatever you want. There's only 50 of you.
I think that's common, right?
I think that just skyrocket the ticket prices and like you get to be like the one person heckling someone and like you know for sure they hear you, they can't ignore it.
Yeah.
There would be people who would pay for that.
Oh, there's definitely people that would.
How much, Greg, since we talk about the Cardinals and their place in the community, take us through so you went to Kirkwood High, correct?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And all three of us are Mizzou J School grads. We can count up our years later. Take us through your relationship with the Cardinals. Were you like born into a Birds on the Bat jersey onesie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we had all the paraphernalia, but I know I had a hat. There's pictures of me with a Cardinal hat, when I was like three or four. And my dad was originally from Long Island and I think grew up a Yankees fan. My grandpa was a big Yankees fan, but my dad, my mom's from St. Louis I was raised in St. Louis. I can't remember a time when I wasn't a Cardinal fan. It was important to my dad that I'd be a Cardinal fan. And I guess, I mean, the first game I remember, so I was born in 68, so probably sometime in the early to mid 70s, maybe. I remember going to a game and the Mad Hungarian struck out the side I think it was bottom of the 10th or something like that, or top of the 10th. And then I think Ted Simmons hit a home run to win the game in extra innings. I have a very vivid memory of that game. I got to look it up somewhere, but that was like the first baseball memory that I had. I remember going to a game as a kid when Reggie Smith was on the team and it was a base clearing brawl. Reggie Smith like basically started a fight with the Dodgers and it was this giant brawl. I remember that. And then a huge baseball card collector. I think Derek, I think a while ago you were doing something on Twitter. You were like, hey, Greg, who are your name five Cardinals that influenced you? Yeah, and I remember, I think I put on there Pete Vukovich because I had his baseball card. He was a pitcher for the Cardinals, and he was actually played a – he played like the mean hitter in Major League.
Ooh, Haywood.
Yeah, Haywood. But that guy, I had a ton of his baseball cards, and that guy was the most generous Cardinal with autographs back in the probably early 80s, yeah, maybe late 70s. He was him and John Denny would always be down there signing autographs. So I remember those two guys really well. And then, of course, in the 80s, I think I was a freshman in high school in 82 when they won it. And, you know, God, that was amazing. You know, that was why I just couldn't believe that the Cardinals. I remember me and my friend Ted Ruger were saying, the Cardinals are in the World Series. And, you know, that wasn't a thing in the 70s at all. They weren't very competitive. So I was like, I can't believe we're here. We just can't embarrass ourselves. And then I think that first game, we got smoked by the Brewers in game one. I can't remember. It was just a beating. We're like, oh no, we're going to look terrible. And, of course, that turned out awesome. And that was when I believe the theme song for that run was, Celebration by Kool and the Gang. And I remember they played it at Kirkwood High School, like in between periods, the whole day after we won, we won the World Series. They played that. And then 85 was, this is my favorite 85 memory, was I was dating this girl, Lisa Canancy. And
shout out, Lisa.
Yeah. Shout out to
Big
Lisa.
Listener. I'm sure she's tuning in.
And so after, and we were at her house with her dad watching game six, and of course everything unravels. And then he had like Mr. Canancy was a huge Cardinal fan, and so was I. And then I think he had like Lisa's mom's sister or his sister. It was her aunt that lived in Kansas City, and she was one of these women that were, you know, like she was kind of into it, you know, but it was just fun for her to watch the baseball game. So she called, Mr. Canancy,
oh, God,
and like gave him like a ribbing about what happened, you know, just like all in good fun. And he starts screaming at her and yelling about it. And she's crying on the other end of the line. She breaks down. She's like, I didn't know it was that big of a deal. He's like, ah, it's ridiculous, man. It's a Dankinger and all this stuff. That's a very vivid memory. And then, let's see. So I graduated in 86, and I went to my first year of college. I went to West Point, you know, the United States Military Academy, my first year of college. And so I didn't get to see any baseball that summer. I was in basic training, and we didn't have TVs or anything like that. And that, but I do remember somehow I got on leave and we watched the Buckner thing, the 86 Mets. Which, by the way, have you guys ever read that book, The Year the Bad Guys Lost?
Yeah. Yep. By Perlman, right?
Yeah. I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. Man. Yeah, that was great. But and then in 87, I went to Mizzou. I transferred to Mizzou, and I remember, you know, that was pretty fun when we played the Twins. And it was, I remember a guy you guys probably don't know. He was a writer for the Post. He was my next door neighbor growing up. He's a guy named John McGuire, and he wrote features for the Post, sort of human interest stuff. You know John?
Yeah, he
was, you know, that guy was so cool to have as a next door neighbor, because, like, you know, Costas was next door there all the time, Rick Hummel and all those guys. And he was just a fun guy. And I would always watch baseball with him sometime. I would watch baseball with him. I watched my dad a lot too, but every now and then I'd go over there and watch with him. And he was just screaming up and down about how the Cardinals got jobbed because this stupid Metrodome was a cracker box. It's not even a real baseball stadium. That's the only reason, you know, cracker box, Homer Dome, which, I mean, yeah. So, and then I think when I was in the 90s, and maybe it's because the Cardinals, you know, weren't great, but in the 90s, I was, I lived in Houston for a while, and I would always go see them when they came to the Astrodome. And I lived in Cincinnati for a while. I was working for Procter & Gamble, selling Pringles and Jif peanut butter and Duncan Hines cake mix. And I don't remember being completely into the Cardinals. And it's maybe because I was getting a career started. I basically had two careers. I was selling peanut butter and potato chips during the day, and I was doing comedy at night to try to get that thing started. And I just didn't have time for it. But as soon as in 2001, I quit my day job and went full time as a comedian. And I was, you know, I've been locked into baseball since then. Like, I've read basically everything you guys have ever written. I follow it pitch by pitch. It's MLB is so great with the technology. You know, I'm on the road all the time, or I was until the last 4 months, but, I've got the MLB app, and it lends itself to comedy because you have a lot of downtime during the day, and you know, you're in a strange place, and you can just sort of be like, all right, I'm going to dial in with the Cardinals every day.
What's the overlap with going to J school and becoming a comedian?
Well, to be real honest, I wrestled when I was at Mizzou, and yeah, that was kind of why I was there, man. I mean, I was a decent student, but that was not. And I wrote for the paper in high school. And honestly, Mr. McGuire was kind of a hero to me. And I thought, well, journalism sounds like a cool thing. And I got into it, and I wound up going into like the advertising track of journalism just to sort of get a degree. And I didn't know. I just was focused on the national tournament and wrestling. When that was over, I was like, I don't know what I want to do. And I kind of chickened out and did not go for comedy right away. I thought I needed to have some sort of a career. So I interviewed around and got a job with Procter & Gamble selling peanut butter and potato chips.
So were you doing comedy in college then, or just kind of like get a guy in a headlock and work out some material?
No, I got the first time I ever did stage comedy was there, you know, the club, it was there when you guys were there, Deja Vu.
Yeah.
A guy on the wrestling team. I was a freshman, and the guy on the wrestling team was a bartender there in the summers, and they had some comedy contest, and he just signed me up without me knowing. And, it was a pretty serious wrestling program. We were in the Big Eight back then. We were not as good as they are now, but we were good. And my coach, Wes Roper, was pretty, I mean, it was like in the fall, and it was sort of preseason, but it was brutal workouts. And on Friday, you know, he comes into practice and he goes, all right, guys, we're going to knock off a little bit early today. We're going to all go down there and watch Warren do comedy at the Voo. And I was like, I didn't even know that he knew I was doing it. So
that's awesome.
It took me a while to get to comedy.
I'm curious what the transition was like between West Point to Mizzou.
Well, it was significantly less discipline, Ben. significantly. Yeah, it was pretty crazy, man. I mean, I went the whole first year to West Point. I did the whole plebe year, and I just decided I really don't want to be in the Army anymore. And you can quit your first 2 years. You're allowed to leave. They try to talk you out of it. You know, I had to go through like 10 different people. And I finally, I'd listen to everything they said, and they'd be like, okay, you understand? I'd be like, yeah. And I'd be like, but I still want to quit. And they'd be like, all right, you got to go talk to this guy.
It's like canceling cable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not quite that difficult. I mean, that's insane, but yeah, it's very much like that. It's very much like that, Ben. And even then I was just a kid, you know, I think I was 18 years old, and I came home and I started making noise about, I might just want to move out to LA and try to become a, you know, comedian or something in show business. And I don't know if I want to go to college. And literally the Mizzou coach, Wes, showed up at my house like 2 days after I got, I left West Point, you know, with a scholarship offer to Mizzou. And my dad was like, you're going to Mizzou. You're going to take this offer. This is what you're going to do, which probably was a good idea. I would have got lost at that point.
Is there an element of competing in wrestling that translates to competing in comedy? And I'll tell you why I asked that is, Vahe Gregorian, who's a friend of both Ben and mine, and another graduate of the J school at Mizzou. Yeah, great writer. I'm sure you've had a chance to talk with him. He and I, when I was in college, we'd always have these conversations about how competing in sport, in a team sport, or, you know, just any sport, how that translated into like a career in journalism or any kind of career, where you learned how and when to dial competition. Like, when is it important to be all out competition, and when is it important to dial that back a little bit and cooperate a little bit, you know? And I wonder how that translates to comedy.
I think the way that it translates the most is sort of dealing with failure. I mean, the work ethic definitely helps. You know, is we put in a tremendous amount of work to wrestle, and to comedy, it takes so long. You're just not good for the first 5 years at all. And you have to have some sort of patience and ability to sort of persevere. It's dealing with failure. But the intensity, I think I made the mistake early on in comedy. One of my buddies was like, "Hey, man, when you're on stage, you look like you're getting ready to wrestle, and it's not good. Like there's an intensity, like you look like you want to fight the audience, and it's really not good." And So I even like early TV appearances, I remember like being gearing up for it. Like I was gearing up for a wrestling match, and I realized it should be the opposite. You know, there's not going to be there's no physical pain when you're doing stand-up comedy. But show business is sort of a lot of ups and downs, and I think, you know, I took some beatings at Mizzou when I was wrestling that helped me learn that.
Do you think that's any of the appeal of baseball too? Like, I mean, it's a game we all talk about, like defined by failure.
Unbelievable. It's such a cliche now, but it's like you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're in the Hall of Fame or whatever. You know, I think that may be one of the reasons I'm drawn to baseball, because I don't know how those guys deal with it. I really don't. And you guys, you talk to them every day. So, but just the slim difference between hitting 350 and 250 is, how do you even recognize that? How does it not feel like an accident?
Yeah. It's interesting. I got to go see actual baseball last night, which was something. My son had a practice, lots of regulations in place, lots of new practices in place, you know, social distance, not near each other. Everybody has their own bat, lots of washing of hands, lots of coordination as to who's coming in when to hit. But it's interesting because I was thinking about that because I was watching the kids and I saw a couple of them, like they celebrated when they got a hit. Right. Like they celebrated when they got a bloop hit in BP that would have gone over the shortstop's head, and they celebrated that. And then there were a couple other kids who would get a bloop hit and go, "Okay, that's not right." And then hit a hard ground ball right at a teammate and go, "That's right." And it dawned on me like, okay, wow. that's a thought process of somebody who's like kind of focused on, okay, right process, right swing, right timing. Bummer of a result versus I judge everything on the result. And I think that's where, you know, major leaguers get or good ball players get is this notion like, okay, I took a good swing. I made contact, I make the right pitch, and I just lined out to shortstop. That's a bummer. But, you know, they get more process oriented than result oriented, which maybe helps them deal with, you know, the wild swings between 250 and 350.
That makes a lot of sense. And it really illustrates why I would have been a terrible baseball player. You know, I tend to celebrate the wins. However we got there. In my later life, my brothers and I, you guys remember Tower T? It's been gone for a couple of years. Some batting cages.
Well, you go there. Yeah, that's where I would go to hit.
It was the coolest place. And the guy, Dave there that owned it, was like classic St. Louis.
Yeah.
And they had 90 mile an hour
Wednesdays.
90 mile an hour Wednesdays. Ben, you know about it? Oh,
yeah. Wait, yes, sir. Oh yeah. We'd go there, but you could talk them into 95.
Really? that guy was the classic, man. Because my brothers, we'd show up on Wednesdays, and Dave's like, "They love the Heat, brother. They line up for the Heat, man. Yep. They're all here for the Heat." I hit the Cubs stink sign over there, man.
So did I.
Show me the T-shirt, and I'll buy it. But
I didn't get a T-shirt.
Dave led me to believe I was the only one. You didn't get a shirt?
I didn't hit it.
You never hit it, Ben?
I didn't get a T-shirt.
Oh, yeah. They have T-shirts.
I just bought the T-shirt.
There's T-shirts that say, I hit the Cubs stink sign. And I remember when I hit it, I was so happy. And I go over to Dave. I'm like, "Dave, when do I get my free T-shirt?" He's like, "Well, I didn't say anything about free. I mean, they're not free. You can buy one." I love that place so much. And apparently, I guess they're going to reopen. They're going to put batting cages in there.
Oh, hopefully. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was like a public pushback, rightfully so. And I think it caused enough noise that they decided to keep it around in some way, shape, or form, which is great. I think it's going to be different owners, I believe, but at least there'll be some piece of it, it's such a place in St. Louis. I mean, how many kids learn to hit there?
It's so great, man. It's got the over, you know, the arm style batting cages.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And before the pandemic, I go to batting cages all over the country. When I'm traveling.
Okay.
Did you really?
Yeah. When I would drive a lot and everything like that, I would stop at batting cages and stuff. Or I always had a glove and a ball, and it's like, all right, well, we'll let a rest stop. We'll play catch here for a little bit and stuff, just to say I did. I took my son on like a Great American Road Trip, and I was like, all right, let's try to play catch in every state that we go through.
Oh, right. That's so great, man. That is so great. Yeah. I'm in Myrtle Beach right now. It's my first gig since I saw you guys. Yeah. And I think I'm going to try to head to the cages. I haven't hit in so long, and the cages here are really tough. It's not the arm, you know, it just sort of drops down and goes, so you can't see the ball coming. Mm. And it's one of those things. It's also, they say it's like 90 or 95 in the fast one, but all they did was just move it closer. So it just comes out. So you never can see it, man. It's almost impossible.
Hey, you know what, that you hit on something though, like that has really preoccupied me during this quarantine time as we kind of all locked down and everything like that is what grassroots baseball will be when we emerge from this, and like whether that's the batting cages everywhere. I mean, because baseball isn't just going to the game. Sometimes it's just going to hang out at a batting cage, right? That's the sport. And you know, that's part of how you find a fondness for a sport is still being able to participate in it, right? So, I mean, as you traveled around, you know, do you think, I mean, for years and years and years, for so much, probably for the entirety of my career, you know, you've heard about, oh, America's pastime, it's going to die. Oh, it's not the number one sport anymore. Oh, this, all that. But baseball's just omnipresent, right? Everywhere you've gone, isn't there some kind of connection to baseball?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think we're skewed because we live in St. Louis and there's the Cardinals. Like, I just can't imagine that there would be no baseball. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And like I said, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm a little sickened by what's going on between the owners and the players. And I think it's probably both their faults. But like I said, I'll come back no matter what they do. Yeah, I wonder. I mean, you said, so how old is your son, Derek?
He's 14.
Yeah. So, okay. So 14. So, and they just started playing.
Yeah. Well, they just got kind of clearance and policies for the league to get going back again. People in the county have been playing a little bit, have been already right. playing for more than several weeks, but this was the league he's in and the team he's with, was in a couple different leagues, and they just kind of got, best practices in place to begin. I think they open in around July 4th. I think they actually were able to get the coaches and the 14-year-olds to agree on a collective bargaining agreement to be ready for July 4th.
Well, the 14, I remember seeing one of my friend's kids play somewhere around that age. It amazed me. They're pretty good at 14, aren't they?
It really varies because you have such different physicality at 14, right? Like, you know, the guys who have already grown and matured and, you know, got some of their, the beginnings of their adult strength versus the late bloomers who are still kind of coming along. But what I've noticed, sort of 13, 14, is that their feel for the game, especially if they've played this long and haven't abandoned it because, you know, another sport has come along or, you know, school doesn't offer baseball or it got too much or it got too time consuming or girls became more of an interest, that if they're playing now, they have a feel for the game. That like athleticism used to overcome, right? You know, you go to see 8-year-old, 9-year-old and the kid with the strongest arm, it doesn't matter what base he throws to. He looks good throwing it. Now they know
That kid is Danny Almonte.
Right. Yeah. He was playing down the rare guy who is a 12 playing at 9, but that's something I've noticed is like, you know, the physicality is very different. Like even the sizes of the kids on his team are different. But their feel for the game at this point and what they know, you know, what they, especially in the field, like they know what to do. It's clear that they've been around and playing quite a bit, and that stands out at that age.
Yeah, that's impressive. What are the pitchers like at 14? Do they throw anything but a fastball and a changeup or?
Oh, curve. No. He faced a lefty that was probably about 4 or 5 inches taller than him last year. A big kid, same age, but a big kid. He was a lefty, and man, he tossed curveballs and
God.
And if he wanted to throw it a little too hard or got a little too ramped up, he would throw a kind of a hard slurve. Not for a strike, but, you know, but yeah, I get to be proud dad here. It's one of my favorite at bats that he's ever made because he got up there. It was in the last game of the year. He'd never seen somebody this tall on the mound, he'd seen left-handers, but tall left-handed with breaking stuff. And, you know, the kid starts him off with a fastball and it's just, and my son goes, all right, well, I'm not going to hit that. That's really hard. And so he chokes up on his bat and steps back in the batter's box. I'm like, that's really awesome that you did that. And then he just started fouling off the breaking pitches until, you know, he came back with a fastball and my son hit a single. I was really thrilled for him. I was like, that's the smartest, even if like he didn't hit a single. It was a really just smart at bat for him to go through and he stayed alive. Yeah,
if my dad witnessed that, he would, and he had the ability, he would make all of the Cardinals watch that at bat.
Harrison, get up there in the front row.
Now, if you're going to go on to tell me at some point, if at some point your son laid down a bunt in this game, he would be the Cardinals hitting coach. As far as my dad's concerned. Oh, my dad is, man, God, he calls for a bunt 10 times a game.
It's awesome.
So where do you stand then on the, like, all right, so you... your fandom really has roots in the 70s. You know, you got to enjoy the celebrate good times of the 80s. You know, your career in comedy dovetails with one of the most successful eras in Cardinal history, where you've probably had a lot of chance to enjoy some of these teams, whether they're charismatic or not. So where's your, I mean, are you pro player win then, or pitcher win and bunts, or are you analytical, or where are you on that spectrum?
You mean are you talking about the DH or
no, like analytics versus like, you know, like just like, oh, like you're saying, like the lay down a bunt, let's play old school baseball, you know, whitey ball and everything like that versus like the grip it and rip it game we have now.
I tend to skew probably mostly because I probably am a jerk and just like to argue with my dad, is I tend to say that analytics and what we do today has, you know, I just trust those guys. I'm like, hey, they know what they're doing, you know, but I got to admit sometimes not so much just the bunting and, you know, I mean the whitey ball, nobody, you know, there was AstroTurf back then. You could do a lot of that stuff, you know, just bounce the ball up and down. But it does get a little boring, not boring, but it's not as fun when it's either walk, strikeout, or home run. It's just that to me, there is something missing from the game. And I think that'll maybe even itself out. You know, I like it when they're, you know, people are spraying doubles all over, and that just seems, I've noticed, I'm not the most observant guy by the way, either, when it comes to baseball, but I've noticed that I probably enjoy the games a little less when there's only that. It is fun though, man, when, you know, it's still, especially live, when you see a home run, it's just so much fun.
Yeah. Are you pro DH?
Man, I think I am only, and I think I've probably heard you guys talk about this, but it's just, they're all playing for the same thing. They're playing to win a World Series. So every team should probably have the same rules throughout the whole season.
Well said.
Yeah. And I think I'm stealing that from you, Ben.
That's just great. The propaganda is working.
That's why he said, well said. He was like, I've said that.
I think that's probably the case. It is fun though. I mean, you know, when effectively La Russa sort of outmanaged Ron Washington, right, in a couple of those games. And that's kind of fun to see, the strategy of utilizing the pitcher and that slot. So I guess I would miss some of that. But, you know, I wouldn't have a problem if they made the pitchers hit in the American League, to be honest with you. Just keep it the same. You know,
are you at all intrigued by, like, what if baseball can get out of its own way here and actually play a season? What, you know, a 50 game, 54 game, 60 game, 72 game season might look like, because just like the craziness of it?
Fascinated by it, man. I think it'll be fun. I mean, I'm just dying for baseball. I got free time. I really want to. I'm fascinated by it. I mean, it'll be so much fun because. And again, I think I've heard you guys talk about this, but I've heard some of the guys on MLB radio talk about it. But it's, you may have one of these teams that there's no way that they're going to be in it for 162, but you could have this team that's not supposed to be in it make a run. Also, you know, from what we saw down in spring training, the Cardinals have. They got to be looking good with all the pitching they have. Let me ask you this. Is there a chance that they would go to like a 6 or 7 man rotation or something like that?
So, yeah, some kind of modified like notion of like you have either a 6-man rotation. That's definitely been talked about because the games will be coming so quick and the preparation might be so short that they'll do a 6-man. Or, you know, it's this old idea that like Dave Duncan and I once kicked around, and I don't mean like Dave, I just was asking Dave like what creative pitching rotations you could do, and he said like, say you only had 3 guys who you could count on for quality starts, well, you could turn to them every 5 days like a normal thing, but then you'd have 3 other guys or 4 other guys in like a shadow rotation, and you might get 4 innings from them, and they alternate as to when they're available for long relief or when they make the start. And it was like a shadow rotation. So it's like you actually have 7 guys who quote unquote start games, but only 3 of them you rely on to go deep into games. And the other ones kind of carve up the 2 remaining games, which I thought was really interesting. So like the Cardinals are well positioned in that regard because they'll have Michaelis back. He's ready to go as much as anybody is. And, you know, they have Gungun Kim still to handle innings. So they could go, and Daniel Ponce de Leon, they could go like with, you know, they could go, okay, here's our 4 guys, and then here's the other guys who are going to start either in a 6-man rotation or supplement those other 4 guys and really, you know, take over game.
I think that's smart. And then you can also have, you know, what you're then having is on like working insurance for inevitably when someone's going to hit a snag, because that's the thing that I think teams have to be most worried about, and kind of why the Cardinals would be at a disadvantage, because pitching is going to be a mess. And guys are going to get sore. They're going to get hurt. They're going to have issues with command and control because this is, they're such creatures of habit, and this is so unique for them. So having as many players as you can in position to make starts would be a wise idea, because you're probably going to need to have some sort of turnover there throughout even a shortened even a shortened season. And then moving forward, you're going to have guys, you know, having as regular seasons as possible heading into, you know, whatever next year looks like. So I think the Cardinals pitching depth is probably, you know, its best asset if they are able to play some sort of season, because there's going to be chaos, I think, in those ranks. And they have some serious and quality backups there. So use them.
Greg, you just want to know what the schedule is so you can see if it overlaps with your schedule, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, well, it's funny. I mean, it really doesn't matter. Other than the hour that I'm on stage, I'll watch. I mean, there's been times when, like, I'm getting called to the stage and I'm like, hold on. I want to see this at bat. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's so funny because people think, like, comedians, like, I'm going to let out a trade secret here, but sometimes, you know, sometimes when I'm on the road, like, I'll wind up going to somebody's house, which is fine. But, you know, and I'll say something like, it's it shows at 8, man. It's 6 o'clock. I better go get ready for the show. That's such a lie. There's no getting ready for the show. Like, what I'm saying is I want to watch the game right up until the moment that I have to be on stage is the truth.
This special that's dropping, Where the Field Corn Grows, was that recorded in Edwardsville?
Yeah. Yeah. We shot it at the Wildy Theater in Edwardsville last summer. It was really fun, man.
What kind of venue is that?
It's an old movie theater that the city put a ton of money into, and it's really, really cool. I wanted the special is a lot about farming and how I don't know much about it. I wanted to do it in a farm community, and I wanted to do it somewhere near St. Louis. So I could have a lot of people that I know there. And I wanted a lot of farmers to be in the audience, and Edwardsville was perfect for it. And there is a little bit of baseball in the special. There's a baseball story about my dad, actually.
Can you offer us a little preview of that?
Well, yeah, basically, I can't remember how I got into it. We shot it a while ago, but basically, like, I think they still have it, but you know promotion that I think Mobile on the Run has, where if the Cardinals score 6 runs or more, you get your coffee for, like, you know, 39 cents at the gas station.
Yeah. 6 is a serious number.
Yeah. 6. So this is one of the most important things in my father's life. Like, this is a really, really big deal to him. 'Cause I think normally the you know, the coffee is, like, you know, 59 cents at the gas station. So it's like he lives by this thing. And, you know, the rule is, I think it doesn't matter whether they win or they lose. As long as they get the 6 runs, you get your coffee. And so, like, you know, we would meet for breakfast, my brother and I and him, somewhere in Kirkwood. And, you know, my dad would be excited. Did you see the game last night? You know, the Cardinals got 6. You get your coffee for 39 cents today. My brother and I don't drink coffee. You know, every day he would say the same thing. And my brother knows all the rules of it. And my brother, just to get him going, he'd be like, no, Dad, they lost. It doesn't count. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It's whether they win or lose. You still get your coffee for 39 cents, you know. I think one time I was watching a game. This is quite a while. It was when Albert was still on the Cardinals. And I'm watching the game. And it's late innings, and the Cardinals are up like 5-0. I think it's bottom in the 8th or something. The game, it's one of those games where we had a pitcher who was cruising. It was probably Waino or somebody, where it's like, they're not going to hit him. You know, it's going to be a complete game. We've got this game won. You know, the game's pretty much over. He's locked into the game because he doesn't know whether he gets his coffee for 39 cents the next morning. And the bases are loaded, and I think Albert's up, and he grounds into a double play, and the inning's over, and he looks at me, and he's like, that seems kind of fishy, huh? Yeah, Dad. Yeah, they're point.
The coffee conspiracy.
Yeah, they're point shaving. The Cardinals are in collusion with Mobile on the Run, so you don't save 15 cents on your coffee tomorrow. We got to get to the bottom of this, Dad. This is That was a late entry into the special, actually. It was funny. I was working somewhere, and I kind of forgot about that joke. And I kind of had the lineup set for the special, and I was working somewhere, and this guy tells me that story to me. This guy, Tommy Jonigan, who's a great, great, great comedian, who's also from St. Louis, Southern Illinois, actually, but he lived in St. Louis doing comedy. And he's like, "Yeah, Tommy Jonigan told me this story about this guy's dad who used to get a coffee for 39 cents. And I was like, "That's my dad. That's my dad. And then he was like, "That thing's hilarious." And I was like, "Really? You remember? I got to put that in the special. I'm going to tell that story." So I think that maybe a little bit else of baseball, but that's the main baseball story.
One of the other things that you do that's tied to St. Louis is the Musial Awards, which has been great. The intros, and you're lobbying for a Musial Award. Has that worked out yet?
No, I haven't gotten one, man. I think there was some video of me taunting everybody at Tower T after I hit that Cub Stink sign, and I'm not sure I'll ever get a sports video again. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if they reopen, there's your chance.
Yeah, maybe, but there's still the video still exists, Derek. The poor sportsmanship that I displayed can never be overshadowed by good sportsmanship. You know, when you shoot the guns at a 9-year old, it's never good, man. So it's gonna stick.
There's a line that can't be crossed.
Exactly, man. Yeah, I'm like a bad. I'm like one of those. Guys in baseball that nobody likes. I'm like Jeffrey Leonard with the one flap down. You guys remember that?
Yeah.
Or there was a guy that my father hated. He said that guy's a hot dog, which my dad was an old wrestling and football coach. If you're a hot dog, yeah, that guy's a hot dog. And it was a guy, you guys are younger than me, but there was a player that played for the Braves named Willie Montanez. And this guy, he was real showy, and my dad couldn't stand him. You know, he flipped the bat a lot. Stuff.
So you're saying your dad's a big Ronald Acuna Jr. fan?
Yeah, I don't think so. Man.
Well, Ronald Acuna Jr. great talent. Everything. Greg, what would you do to help promote? What would be an idea to promote baseball better? Because baseball is going to have to come back from this mess, from this acrimony, this back and forth, this ugliness. And baseball's never been really good at capitalizing on personalities.
Yeah. And honestly, I haven't given a ton of thought. I tend to be a little bit of old school. Like, just the game is so great. Just let it speak for itself. But that's probably not the answer. I'm playing old tapes. I don't think that probably works with the younger generation. So, I would probably yield the floor to an idea man like Ben Fredrickson.
he's going to remind me of that forever now, Greg. Thanks.
Well said.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, here's what I would do, Derek. I think this is how you bring baseball back. ExxonMobil, that's a national chain. Mobile on the Run is a national chain. You take six is a serious number nationwide, but hear me out here. Three is a serious number. Huh? Are you guys with me?
Yeah.
Cardinal, the home team scores three or more runs, and you get your coffee. Actually, kids don't drink coffee. You get an icy for 19 cents. Now we're talking. Okay, that's how you bring baseball back.
I like it. You can stick with six as a serious number, and then just play six games. And they pay players for six
It is six, a very serious number at this point. And it is extremely serious, as in the future of the game serious number.
It'll take care of those short attention spans.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I don't know. I go back to what Derek said, where how is it that we've got kids, you know, 14-year-olds figuring this out and playing with what they feel, you know, what they've determined to be hopefully, you know, completely safe regulations and easing back into games and enjoying it. And the guys that everybody wants to see, you know, no offense to the 14-year-olds around the country, but the guys that, you know, get paid to play the national pastime can't figure it out. That there's something wrong with that.
Do you think this is a stall tactic so mm-hmm. that they can just play less games?
Yeah. I think there are two things in play here. One is that, you know, the players really changed the conversation with their response and rejection of the recent proposal by saying, look, if your intent is to impose a short season on us, get it over with. Tell us where and when. And it was really for the first time that I can remember where the union stole the catchphrase, like got the catchphrase and got on the same message. And one of the things that we've talked about, you know, just internally, other reporters, you know, folks in baseball and everything like that, is how galvanized, that's the word that comes up, how galvanized the players feel. But what was their message? Like, where was their unifying rally cry, right? Where was their point that they wanted to play too? Because for so long, it was the owners making proposals, saying they wanted to play. And the players were the ones going, whoa, wait a minute. What about safety? Whoa, wait a minute. We want to play more games. Whoa, wait a minute. But now they have their rally cry that tell us where and when. And I think that really changed the conversation and put the owners for the first time back on their heels, because it, and also the threat of a grievance, especially one with a $1 billion price tag that was being threatened. So if they imposed a shortened season, then the union could come back and say, look, that was your intent all along. You should pay us for the lost wages. And it just changed the conversation greatly. So there is an element of delay. If they can delay, go through things. There is also, and we'd be remiss not to say this, there is genuine fear, Greg, of the virus. And
yeah,
if the second wave, when it comes back, or even now, like baseball is looking at a couple of the cities that they considered, you know, for like a hub plan, right? And there has been quick rises, sweeping rises in the virus there. So they couldn't even play there now anyway. And it's just they can't transport the entire league to Disney like NBA wants to. You know, they really had some pushback from the players, and rightfully so, when it came to the hub plan, which hockey is going to implement. So, you know, you can see where baseball is in a bind because it has to also deal with so many different policies. And one outbreak, a team that gets multiple positive tests, just the whole thing comes tumbling down.
Yeah, and I think everybody would be forgiving and understanding if that happened, you know?
Yeah, good point.
But that's not what's going on. I mean, that's not the only thing that's going on. And right. Now I think I read this morning that Fauci said they shouldn't play too far into October. Did you guys see that?
Right past the end of October. Yeah. That's the second wave. Right. Yeah, get in, get out has always been the rule of thumb that the experts have told baseball.
I think there's another kind of theory too, that they want to, in order to hit that window, you know, being done by October, but also having the shorter season. I think the owners are somewhat fearful if they impose the shortest season now, the players will then counter with, well, why didn't you impose a longer season? And since you did it this early, if the owners find ways to delay a little bit longer before they quote unquote impose the season, then all of a sudden that grievance doesn't carry as much weight.
You also have the reality that the real jackpot for baseball is in the postseason and the revenues from playoff games, which is why they want to expand the playoffs, which means a shorter season too, to have another round or two of playoffs. But their broadcast partners don't want the games to go into November. There are multiple reasons for that. One that was brought to my attention was there's a presidential election. And while that's early on in November, that's going to be where a lot of the networks are focused and where a lot of the ratings are focused. And I would imagine that's where a lot of, you know, material for news and comedy will come from. So, you know, they don't want to compete with that.
And interestingly enough, I think, you know, the dispute between the players and the owners may be more contentious than that presidential election.
Yeah. Well, let me close here by asking this then, Greg. Like, as a big baseball fan, what happens if a month from now, a month and a half from now, the NBA is playing, the NHL is playing, and baseball is not? Do you maybe find other interests? I mean, does baseball run the risk here of being the one without a chair when the music stops?
You know, I think it runs the risk of losing fans. It won't lose me. And that doesn't mean I won't watch the NBA and watch the NHL. And I'm definitely not I lived in Houston for a couple of years during the Olajuwon years, and that was pretty awesome. And I got into the NBA, but you know, I live in St. Louis. I'm a St. Louis fan, and I don't really watch a lot of the NBA. I try to support the Blues, but I'm just not as passionate about hockey. It was so cool what happened last year. So I'll watch it, but like I said, man, they'll always get me back. But I would worry about, you know, I got a nephew who's 1.5, and maybe he won't be into baseball at all.
I think that's a great point. I don't think they're going to lose the Greg Warrens, but they might lose the next generation of them. You know, if their dads are so mad that they, you know, that they aren't getting their coffee for 6 runs, or they're just, you know, have a sour taste about baseball in their mouth, that stuff trickles down. I mean, and that stuff does matter. So baseball, I think, has this weird sense of like where it now fits on the national radar. And it's not in as good of a spot as it seems to think. And I don't think it will like its spot if it goes a season without playing while these other sports are able to come back, hopefully virus permitting, and have these fascinating, very intriguing postseasons. And, you know, look, what kills me is no one's looking down the road, because we could have this conversation again in 2021, depending on if fans are going to be able to be in stands, and there's no sign that there won't be a work stoppage after that, when the new CBA has to be agreed upon. I mean, how many years are you going to go without a season? 2, 3? I mean, that's no league would look good coming back from that, especially not baseball. So that's what I can't get out from thinking about. It just seems like the people actually involved in the discussions are not thinking about.
If that happens, if you go another year, if they go another year, next year, because of the CBA, and they don't play, it's not. I don't think you're losing fans so much because, you know, they're mad, but people lose interest. You forget about stuff. You know,
yep.
I'll be back, but a lot of kids will just be like, I don't. Oh yeah, baseball. I kind of remember that.
Oh, Mike Trout, he was great. Now he's just old.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all kind of romance baseball and its role it's played in bringing the country back from other crises. You know, I wonder if the other sports come back first and get a crack at that, if maybe they're remembered more for bringing the country back or uniting the country after this crisis. And that in that way, baseball would surrender its cultural touchstone.
That's a long, hard call, but it could happen. Yeah, it'd be funny when you hear NASCAR brought us back from a disaster. It just doesn't
sound. Yeah. A rip in Tom Brady's pants. Where were you when? So, Greg, you have a show this evening, a lot of shows on the road. Are you back slowly part of the reopening then?
Yeah, it's a little bit here and there. You know, normally I'm doing something every week, you know, for the last 20 years. But now, like, I'm working a couple weeks in June, a couple weeks in July, a couple weeks in August, and, you know, a week in September. And I don't think comedy is going to be back to normal for, you know, probably until there's a vaccine. So there's places that are trying. I think the Funny Bone in St. Louis is going to try something starting in mid-July, and they'll be at like 50% occupancy, and I'm in Myrtle Beach right now, and it's 50% occupancy, and it was fun. Last night was the first time I was on stage for 4 months. It was a lot of fun. But
wow, you know, what was that experience like with the people getting to laugh then, like around people?
It was great. I mean, they were, it was as good of a crowd as you can imagine. They were just, you could just tell they were thrilled to be out. And there was probably a little tension because they were like, I wonder if this guy remembers his act, you know, and it came back to me pretty quickly. It was really fun. You know, I just remember, I love doing stand-up comedy. It's the most comfortable hour of the day for me is when I'm on stage. I just love it. And, you know, I didn't get to do it for 4 months, and I think it probably reminded me how much I love doing it. So I think it'll be sort of, it's not something I can bank on doing all the time for a while, but when I get the chance, it's pretty fun.
It is pretty cool. I did think of where comedy and baseball overlap there, just in your description. It's in community. It's in shared experience. That's a big part of both of them.
Yeah, I think so, man. I would say in any negotiation, the club owners have a much bigger upper hand than the comedians do. At
least only a lockout is like literal, right? You get locked out of the club.
Yeah.
Where the Field Corn Grows, it's with 800-pound Gorilla Records. June 30th, it drops on Amazon, Amazon Prime, Direct, Google Play, Xbox, Video, and Vudu. July 21st, the album drops. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. Next time, let's do this in person, in face-to-face. Yeah,
that would be awesome, man. This was really cool, man. I listen to the podcast all the time. It helped get me through the pandemic. And
thanks for saying that.
I've honestly read probably everything both of you guys have written, and I'm big fans. So it was really, really cool to get to do this.
Thank you so much for saying that. They reached out to say, would you have you on? I'm like, I'm flattered that you want to come on. This is great. Oh, yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, great to hear your voice, man. Thanks for following along, and good luck tonight. And we're glad you're back up there and back where you belong. So congrats on that, and hopefully we all are back where we belong here before too long.
Yeah, I'd like to be in the seat with Ben at a show. Here, let's plan that, Ben.
Let's do it.
Oh, that's fantastic, you guys.
A special thanks to St. Louis's own Greg Warren, who, again, you can find his special, Where the Field Corn Grows, on Amazon, Amazon Prime Direct, Google Play, Xbox, Video, and Vudu on June 30th. That's June 30th for Where the Field Corn Grows. The album from the performance in Edwardsville drops on July 21st, wherever you get your albums. The Best Podcast in Baseball has been brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. You can find all of our Constant Cardinals coverage in the pages of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or online at stltoday.com, where you'll find a whole galaxy of podcasts. You'll also find ongoing coverage as negotiations continue, ramp up, and urgency persists for the union and the owners to come to some kind of an agreement to save the 2020 season. By the time this podcast posts, there will already have been developments. It's moving that fast, and they still have yet to answer the biggest question of all, if not where and when they'll play, but what are they going to do to protect the players from the coronavirus, especially if they're going to be able to play in all of the home cities. You can find the Best Podcast in Baseball wherever you get your podcasts. It's available on iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes. You can rate and review the podcast. I do go and read those regularly. You can subscribe to the podcast there on iTunes. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make this podcast possible. And really, we need to keep this podcast going, right? Because Greg's got to have something to listen to while he cleans. Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Best Podcast in Baseball. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. We'll be back next week with a new episode of BPIB. Talk to you soon. Stay healthy. And maybe we'll have, like, you know, a schedule to dissect, or games to discuss, or a report date to, you know, ruminate on. Something. I mean, anything.